Welcome to the May Citizens Climate Lobby International Call. We have had a call every single month for 6 years. So there's three things we do on this call. Every single month we educate ourselves. Every single month we practice speaking about the issue because we feel like we've also got to be able to communicate more effectively on the issue. And then we get into action. So all of that is aimed towards getting an effective price, tax, fee on carbon with money recycled to U.S. House and Canadian households, as we believe that that is the fastest way to deal with global warming, climate change. What's going to be happening on this specific call is in just a moment I'm going to introduce Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island, who we are very excited to have on the call. I think of the hundreds of comments that have come into Senator Whitehouse's office about the carbon tax discussion draft, I suspect that many of those are from people on this call who are very enthusiastic about making their thoughts known on what would be an effective way of dealing with climate change. I think the people on this call have also been very inspired about many of the speeches that Senator Whitehouse has been making on a regular basis on the Senate floor. One of the reasons that I know how enthusiastic people are, Senator Whitehouse, is I have received hundreds of emails over the last couple of years every time you give a speech, people sending me notes saying, you've got to watch this speech. So for all of you who sent me those notes, I want you to know I did see them. They were great, and thank you for making sure that I saw them also. So I know that our people have been really moved and inspired, not just about the frequency, but also how powerful and how inspiring those speeches have been. And, you know, you started doing those way before it became conventional wisdom in Washington, D.C., that you could start talking about climate change and global warming again. So we're all extremely appreciative.
It's conventional wisdom now that you can start talking about it again? Good.
Yes. Yes, you can. So, yeah. Surprise. Let me just tell you a little bit about the people you're talking to before you get a chance to start your remarks. The people who are on this call are the kind of people who don't think just because you vote and you pay your taxes, that necessarily makes you a citizen. They're the kind of people who think that you need a little bit more skin in the game. And I think that when we met with you last July during our conference, we showed you our media packet and the volunteers were generating 30 to 40 letters to the editor and op-eds a month, trying to really impact the discussion regarding global warming and climate change. During that conference, we visited 303 members of the House and Senate, mostly staff. This year, we plan to see the entire House and Senate, and also when we bring you our media packet this year, we've gone from a rate of 30 to 40 a month to 100 to 150 letters and op-eds every month trying to create will, not just in the Beltway, but as you heard, in Omaha, Nebraska, in Lincoln, in Austin, Texas, in Sudbury, Ontario, in Missoula, Montana. So throughout the entire country so that there are people reaching out every single week to try and create an environment in which we can have effective, constructive discussions about climate change and global warming. The last couple of things that I want to say about the people you're talking to is what astounds me on a regular basis is they never seem to take the easy way out. And the easy way out, by that I mean, is just talking to people you agree with and complaining about, you know, accepting the conventional wisdom and saying things are too hard or too politicized in Washington, D.C. I mean, certainly anybody who wants to can gather as much evidence they want that things are too politicized to get things done in D.C. So that would be one way people could deal with it. The people on this call say, yeah, that's one of the circumstances I'm dealing with, but we need a political solution, which means that citizens need to be engaged and more citizens need to be engaged. The last thing I'll say is this is, we have a lot of scientists on the call, so a lot of scientists end up forming our groups. In fact, the group that started in Missoula this week, actually one of the people is a Nobel Prize winning scientist from the last IPCC effort. And the group that started in Pasadena, California, was formed by some of the people who helped form it were scientists and engineers at Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And I love talking to them because lots of times people say we can't do interesting or big things anymore. And they look you in the eye and they say, listen, last year we just landed something the size of an SUV on Mars. Don't tell me we're not capable of doing big or interesting things. The other people who helped start that group were school teachers. And we have a lot of school teachers who started Citizens Climate Lobby groups. The last thing I would say about them is most of them have jobs. Most of them have families. So they have two full-time jobs. And then they treat their activism as another full-time job. They are very busy working every day, every week to make something happen. So, Senator Wethouse, I know we submitted some questions to you that we would love to get you if there's time, but let me just first of all, again, say how inspired we are by the work you've done and give you as much time as you'd like to make any opening remarks you'd like to make, and then we'll get into some of the questions that we submitted. Welcome.
Thank you very much, and thank you to everybody in the Citizens Climate Lobby who's participating. Particular shout-outs to Rhode Islanders Mary Jane Sorrentino, Allison Glassy, and Ed Detman. But welcome, everyone, and you guys really are part of the solution, and I'm honored to have the chance to participate in this call. I think you are absolutely right that the present political conditions do not allow for a meaningful response to carbon pollution. Specifically, what I think the best answer is at this point is a carbon pollution fee. So that means we have to change the political conditions. And I think that that can be done. I think that the tools for making that happen are right around us right now. And I think that if you put together a couple of them, the conditions will emerge where we can take a significant carbon action. I think the first thing, and we need to keep a lot of pressure on the White House, the first thing is that there has to be serious regulatory action on carbon. If there isn't serious regulatory action on carbon that the polluters are looking at, then they've got a status quo in which nothing is coming at them from the executive branch. They own the legislative branch, and everything is great. So you've got to change that balance, which means that the executive branch, which is not so much under the control of the polluters, needs to step up and continue their work on the new carbon plants, coal plants, go after the existing coal plants, go beyond that into refineries and factories, and also use the purchasing power of the government to press carbon and climate issues. I think a very serious effort on that part changes the equation for the polluters, because now they've got to clean up their act with no support from anyone. They may fight it for a while and hire lawyers and lobbyists and do all that, but ultimately, for them, it's a losing proposition. Whereas if there's a carbon fee of some kind, it gives them a chance to get access to some of that funding in order to defray the costs associated with shutting down their coal plants and their carbon emissions. And that, I think, helps change the game. That's one piece. The second piece is that we need to get active and keep the pressure on. And I think the means for doing that, the Citizens Climate Lobby is a really strong grassroots base. I would frankly like to see a super PAC that can raise big money from people like Mike Bloomberg and step onto the political landscape and give some of our opponents a bit of a scare. Because right now, in terms of the big money, it's only the Koch brothers, the oil and gas industry, the coal industry. We're not, you know, the phrase, bring a knife to a gunfight? We're not even bringing a knife to a gunfight. We're bringing a feather to a gunfight. I mean, it would be helpful to have some really strong ability to go after some of the worst folks on this and create a political penalty for being wrong on carbon. And the third is, I think we have so much support throughout a whole variety of different places, everything from the property casualty and reinsurance industry through the national security and military leaders, through obviously environmental groups, very significant retailers who are affiliated with carbon issues and ready to be engaged. On and on and on, the list goes. And I think we need have somebody step up and basically take charge of a gathering of the clans where all the different industry groups that support this are brought together and can have the feeling that there's a strategy, that there's a plan, that they're not just out there on their own, that we're going to work together. And in the same way that a field marshal has different divisions who get deployed at different places and tasked to do different things, and collectively together they are how the battle is won, we need to have that kind of a marshaling of the various divisions that we have out there. Faith groups, we have outdoor fishing and hunting groups, we've got I think very strong new media powers. So I think with those tools all deployed together, we can change this thing. We just need to step up and do it. But the key is that the Obama administration has to get serious about the regulatory side, and after that, things get a little bit better. Now, let me say one thing before I open for questions. I have a pet project that I would love to have people's help with, and if you're interested, you can contact my office and they can connect you to the project. But I think we need to have a climate wiki, a curated climate wiki, where people who are across the country can cull out of the local news things that are happening in their districts, in their states, that show that climate change is really happening, that it's happening now, that it's happening here, and that real-life responsible people are dealing with it and responding to it. Because when I give my speeches on the Senate floor, first of all, thank you all for listening and tuning in, because there's usually nobody in the room. It's reassuring to know that out there people are listening. But when I give those speeches, I can say that the Sierra Club says something, or that the IPC says something, and my opponents on the other side suffer no discomfort from that. They are politically very happy to be cast in opposition to a UN organization like the IPCC, or to what they consider to be a liberal organization like the Sierra Club. What makes them uncomfortable is if I can show that the North Carolina Highway Department has had to lift the highways going out to the Outer Banks, and the reason they did so, they said, was storm surge from climate change. That a mayor in Florida has had to move the sewage treatment plant further back from the ocean because he's worried about storm surge. That the Idaho Quail Hunting Association has noted in its annual publication the habitat changes that have come from climate change. That the Oklahoma University Department of Meteorology has published a paper crediting the validity of climate change. Then I can go to senators in the Carolinas and Florida and Idaho and Oklahoma, and now they're in a hot spot, and they have a problem denying that their own folks in their own states are credible on this subject. But there's no really easy way to find that. So I'd love to be able to go across the state, see who's talking about this, click a link on my computer on their state, and pick up the top 10 things that are currently undeniably happening in their state on climate change, and then ask them to dispute their governor, their mayors, their academic leaders, their hunting and fishing groups, their own citizens, their own constituents. So I'll close with that. If you're interested in that as an idea, Emily Enderle, E-N-D-E-R-L-E, at my office is helping to coordinate that effort.
Okay, and then just so everybody knows, a follow-up on that, Emily is speaking at our conference, so if you don't connect with her in advance of that, you'll get a chance to meet her at our conference. So she'll be one of the people on the congressional panel. I think, Senator, we are an organization that are uniquely positioned to do that, and in fact, a lot of the research that we're going to be doing in advance of the conference includes some of the categories you mentioned, but specifically, for instance, when we started our Nebraska chapters, one of the meetings that they set up that unfortunately didn't happen was the head of the Nebraska Farmers Association. And we're with you, that believing that we really need the people who are out in the field, who are being impacted, who aren't, you know, considered part of, aren't easily pigeonholed, first of all, just like you said, and aren't just part of the Beltway reality, but are the people actually feeling it on the ground. And we are doing that kind of research district by district for our meetings, but I think we're also uniquely positioned to help you with that project.
Good.
Let me just get to something that you brought up, and then we'll get to some of the questions we'd set in advance. So you talked about the president using EPA authority, and given the Supreme Court said in Massachusetts versus the United States that the president does have the authority to use EPA authority, and we think that's crucial also because we think without that hammer that there's no incentive for Congress to act. So we think that is absolutely the president does act on that authority. But one thing that concerns me is this. I think that the EPA is one of the most successful entities in the history of our country, private or public. And some people have talked about, you know, trading off EPA authority for legislation. Do you have views on that? I would say most of the people in our organization would be uncomfortable with that because EPA has been able to do so many good things, but other legislative proposals have talked about ceding some EPA authority for policy. Do you have an opinion on that?
I see the point that once a really solid carbon standard has been established by legislation, it's not as necessary for EPA to engage in a separate regulation, rulemaking, and enforcement regime. The problem is that we're probably not going to get as forceful a carbon program as we would want. And so you could easily get into a situation in which you're really not getting a strong enough carbon program legislatively, and yet you're being asked to trade away EPA authority at the same time.
Right.
And to the extent that they're really redundant and that we're really solving the problem legislatively, then I'm willing to concede that dialing back some of EPA's authority could well make sense. But I think for the people who are pressing that point of view, that's not really what they're going for. What they're trying to do is to avoid strong carbon programs, water down what we can do in the legislature, and as the price of the watered down bill, also take away EPA's authority, and I think that would be a real mistake. So I wouldn't rule it out, but I would look at those proposals with real suspicion.
Okay, thank you for that. So let's just talk a little bit about the process you're in right now. So you sent out a discussion draft. The due date for comments on that was April the 12th. I know that there were a lot of comments and that it wasn't just a lot of comments by number, but a lot of material in there, and I'm sure it'll take quite a bit of time for your staff to wade through those comments. Do you have some type of time frame from here or anything you can give us an idea about what you would see happening next with that process?
Well, we are going to, as you know, we did an original call just of letters for comment about climate change, and we have actually some wonderful responses from groups you might not expect. How about the National Basketball Association?
Wow.
Writing in to say, look, climate change is deadly serious, and it's hitting home in parks and playgrounds around the country where young people, because of air conditions and because of unprecedented levels of heat, actually can't play our sport. And this is serious. And so I hadn't actually thought of them as a potential ally, but if they're willing to put some, you know, well-known basketball players out with that message, that really adds new and surprising and I think convincing for many people, certainly attention-getting voice to the equation. So that was the first step, and we're still finishing up with that. We have the information in now in terms of the specific responses to what the carbon pollution fee would look like, and we're going to evaluate that largely in the context of designing carbon pollution fee legislation. But I suspect that we'll do a sort of survey of what's come in so that people who did answer get some feedback. I don't want to completely swamp our staff because we don't have a huge amount of people dedicated to it, but we do want to get information out that we can. I do want to say that working with Henry Waxman and his staff is a real privilege.
Mm-hmm.
He's an incredibly experienced and determined legislator. He has a renowned legislative staff, and it's really been terrific to work with him and with them. And then we are also, you know, separately putting together a stronger relationship with the executive branch of government, so that people like Heather Zeichel in the White House have actually come up to the Senate and spoken to people, and in the frame that I mentioned of the gathering of the clans, having there be a sense of a plan and a purpose and a strategy. We don't send that message very well if the Democrats in the Congress and the Democrats in the White House aren't coordinated. So we're pulling that together and putting together a list of all the various things that the White House can do and should do just through its executive powers to bear in on climate change. So we'll actually have a menu we can present to the White House to say, look, here are the things we think that you should be doing. Here are the different groups that support all these different ones. Please get on the stick. And now you have some accountability as to what they've done and what they haven't done. So that's the process going forward. And we hope it'll culminate in a piece of carbon legislation that is ready at around the time that we've got a strategy going forward and we can start to swing into action.
Great. Well, one of the questions that came in as part of that in terms of a menu of options was from the Rhode Island group, and they wanted to know if you're also in communication with the Boxer Sanders effort. Are people collaborating, and how much collaboration is there between the effort they've had with the bill they introduced and what you're doing?
We are in constant touch. Barbara is my chairman on the Environment Public Works Committee, and Bernie is one of the most committed people in the Senate. I think behind me you'll find him and Al Franken and Barbara Boxer as the three senators who spent the most time on this issue on the Senate floor. So we are talking all the time. We're in touch also with Maria Cantwell, who's had some very good ideas on this subject in the past, and indeed with a great number of our colleagues to try to move their attention to this issue and get their support.
Yeah. I think one of the things you are aware of is I think we're the only organization that works on climate change, and specifically climate change legislation that spends more time on Republicans than Democrats.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been to Senator Inhofe's office 3 times. We've been to Senator Sessions' office 3 times. We've been to Representative Cantor's office 7 times. And it's not that we expect to flip anybody who doesn't believe on science in one meeting, but we think if we can engage them in the solution, we have a better chance of success. And it also speaks to one of the things you were talking about earlier is getting, you know, some leaders in industry. We have a group of people that have been doing nothing but working out to executives in oil companies, thinking if they speak out, that gives a lot of cover to people who maybe are hiding under bad science. But in terms of reaching out to scientists, you know, we have focused a lot on the two senators from Tennessee because of what they've said before. Both senators in Arizona have sponsored climate legislation before. Senator Collins in Maine co-sponsored Senator Cantwell's bill. So those are some of the people we've been focused on. But are there other Republicans that you think it would make sense for us to increase our efforts with?
I think those are the main ones. I think it helps to be from a well-educated state.
Mm-hmm.
It helps to be from a coastal state. And I think it doesn't help yet, but I think it will help if you have considerable political ambitions, because I think the Republicans have to see that the path that they're on right now, if they have any good sense at all, is a dead end. I mean, it's really a silly bet to say that we're going to stake our entire claim down where 3% of the scientists, most of whom are in the pay of the polluting industry, think that there's pay dirt, and we're going to go against every single established scientific organization, including, by the way, the folks at NASA who managed to land that explorer on Mars, not people who are dummies.
Yeah.
And we're going to, and I think we've also got to gear up the business community on them, because obviously the Republican Party is very responsive to the business community, And so the more we can have that gathering of the clans and show them that retailers, insurers, high-tech companies, green energy companies who have jobs in their states, all those things, let them know that it's a losing proposition to marry the oil and coal and gas industries and let them take you down with all of America looking. So, you know, I think Lisa Murkowski, I think, has a lot of potential. Kelly Ayotte has a lot of potential. Both Maine senators have potential, I think, up and down the coast. Lindsay has a primary to get to, but at some point, I think this, you know, the things that are happening on the coast of North and South Carolina are pretty undeniable. Marco Rubio, if he wants to be president one day, I don't think wants to be associated with the kind of lies and deliberate blindness that characterizes the current state of the anti-carbon, of the carbon polluters movement. So it's a question of building up the pressure on them and building up the spotlight so that they can't dodge the question. They have to address it regularly. And each time they address it, I think they're in a difficult situation. They either have to kind of come to terms with us and with reality, or they have to associate themselves with some pretty reprehensible behavior.
Yeah. You know, as part of that, former Secretary Shultz had a piece in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago. And I think that if you talk to almost every volunteer on this call, there's probably somewhere between 600 and 700 people on the call, they're pretty familiar with the basic conservative view, conservative economist view of this, which is that you have a failure of the market and that we're not incorporating the externalities in the price of carbon-based fuels.
Yeah.
So Secretary Shultz wrote that piece saying we do need to, you know, use Pagodian taxation, incorporate the externalities, include the cost of society, and that he believes, as we do, that that the money should go back to American households to help them make the transition while we switch over to renewable energy. What did you think of Mr. Shultz's piece, and what do you think of his approach, and do you think people like him speaking out helps our cause?
I liked his piece. I think people like him speaking out helps our cause a lot, and I think that it was very helpful in laying out some of the areas where we would carry unnecessary baggage in dealing with Republicans on this issue. So, for instance, what do you do with the money after you've raised it? Well, if you're a Republican looking at this issue, it is a very different thing if all of that money goes straight back to the American people than it is if you've got government doing what they call picking winners and losers, if you've got government carving out a big share for itself in order to grow itself and expand its authorities. That creates a whole secondary kind of political overlay about this that, from a pure climate perspective, I don't really care about. And if it's going to take letting every dollar go back to the American public to get this done, we can have the fights about other financial issues in other arenas. We're constantly arguing about those in our budget discussions, in our appropriations discussions. You know, we don't have to give up that fight. We just have to, I think, be smart about not trying to import it into this if the Republicans are giving us the signal that if we can do it this way, they'll be much more inclined to support it.
Okay, well, then let's talk about Democrats a little bit. I'm going to mispronounce her name, Theda Skocpol, the Harvard climate scientist who wrote the 120-page critique of what happened in the Waxman-Markey attempt and the failure for us to get effective climate legislation passed. She talked about a couple of things. One was not enough support outside the Beltway, and we certainly are working hard trying to do that. But she's also said in recent interviews that rather more than Tea Partiers, she's worried about what she calls wobbly Democrats. And I have to say, I was a little bit, felt like I was kind of hit in the stomach by a baseball bat on the vote on guns a couple of weeks ago, thinking that we could trust Democrat votes a little bit more solidly when push came to shove. Could you just say, I like her term wobbly Democrats, but is there anything you can say about what we should be doing to pay attention to Democrats that we need to make sure are in play on votes on things like climate change?
Yeah, I'd say three things about that. The first is that I think we will do better when it comes to a real vote. And it's a win-or-lose proposition. Mm-hmm. We had that budget amendment that I put forward in the
right.
back in April. And we got 41 Democratic senators on board. If Frank Rotenberg had been there, it would have been 42. That's actually a pretty strong base, considering that it wouldn't accomplish anything. And the people who were, you know, willing to help if it really was going to make a difference, but were going to take a lot of heat for the vote, there's no upside for them in voting for us and just, you know, creating all that heat to no effect. So that's the first thing. The second is that we've got to change, as I said at the beginning, the political conditions that we're operating in so that the political calculation that senators make leans more in favor of doing something, and they will know that they will get strong political support if they take this vote, and they won't just have to face a lot of smear ads from the Koch brothers and the coal industry. So bringing that into balance, I think, helps. And then finally, I think it's important to recognize that as much as this is a Democrat versus Republican vote, it's also very much a regional vote. And the states that are heavily dependent on coal for their economy as on the mining side, or that are heavily dependent for coal on the electricity production side, they have, you know, issues that need to be addressed that are, to a degree, legitimate issues and merit some attention. And if they feel that they're just going to get rolled, then I think it's going to be a tougher fight than if they feel there's a hand reaching out to them saying, look, we understand that in, you know, Missouri, that electric power co-ops burn 100% coal. We have to figure out a way to transition that so that, you know, Missouri doesn't just take it on the chin. I'm a little bit less sympathetic to that argument than many because Rhode Island's already done it on its own, and other states have already done it on their own. And to a certain extent, rewarding bad and slow behavior is not the greatest strategy. But on the other hand, practicality, I think, dictates that you've got to figure out how to address the local considerations that are very real for many of these folks.
Okay, well, good. Let me see if I can get one last question. And first of all, there were quite a few people who sent comments in who, when they knew you were on the call, wanted me to make sure and know how much we appreciate not only what you do, but the remarkable work your wife has done to protect our oceans. And so
she is an oceans champ. She really is. I'm delighted. She's been really wonderful. Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, and I actually, one of our, well, actually Marshall Saunders, our founder, said that he read a comment from you one time that when the two of you saw An Inconvenient Truth, you were alarmed, and she was relieved, saying, oh, my goodness, finally people know what I've always known.
Yeah, very true. And to that point very quickly.
Yes, please.
We need to make sure that in our climate discussion, we remember the oceans part of this discussion.
Yeah.
Because as much as the other side is kind of dirtied up, climate change, dirtied up the science, dirtied up cap and trade through the propaganda campaign, the oceans really haven't come into it yet, and it brings in new audiences. And while estimations of where the climate is going to go require a certain amount of modeling that is somewhat complicated, what's happening in the oceans, you can actually go out and measure. You measure the sea level rise, you measure the warming temperatures, you measure the changing acidity. There's really not much room for a scientific debate about that, and it's coming home to roost in big ways. Indeed, I suspect the first really bad punch that humankind takes from climate may very well come through the ocean rather than through the atmosphere, as there's a species crash somewhere from acidification or something like that taking place. So the oceans is, I think, a valuable, relatively untouched, and convincing part of the climate discussion, and being terrestrial beings, we often overlook it.
Yeah, you know, one of our groups are all volunteer groups. One of them is made up all of PhD candidates at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. So they have been feeding us a lot of information from the ocean, including one of our speakers a few months ago was on the topic of ocean acidification. And boy, if people were alarmed about polar bears losing habitat, I think they could be really scared about, you know, starting to see evidence of things like the shells of plankton might break down,
yep.
You know, where the bottom of the food chain is in jeopardy. If that doesn't get your attention, I don't know what would.
Yeah. I talk about on the Senate floor what I call the humble pteropod which nobody really cares about. It's a tiny little species about the size of your little fingernail at its biggest. But it's what salmon feed on. And if your pteropod falls out, the salmon falls out. And if salmon falls out, you've got a real gaping hole in the food chain and a gaping economic hole up and down the West Coast, particularly in Alaska, home of Senator Murkowski.
Yes, and that's one of the things our Alaska group has tried to continue to point out is why, obviously, Alaska is a huge energy state. Fishing is the second biggest industry, and their fishermen are extremely alarmed about what's happening in the ocean up there. So it is one of those local kinds of things that you keep bringing up that we think is important and that we'll be doing research on in advance of the conference.
Yes, okay, we will win this with local arguments, not with global ones.
Yeah,
it's a global issue, but we will win it with local arguments.
Yeah, and just so you know, we are not casually preparing for any of the meetings we have with members of Congress. Every single member is being researched carefully, and it does have to do with local impacts, but it also has to do with what their faith is. It has to do with what their hobby is. I mean, you'll remember this better than most of the people on the call. I don't know why you end up with so many people named Senator Warner from Virginia, but, you know, I think three iterations ago, we were surprised when he introduced a climate bill, and then we found out he loved trout fishing.
Yeah.
And trout are really sensitive to temperature, and that we're reducing the area in which people can fly fish.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is finding those specific things that we think are important.
It absolutely is.
Well, so, Senator, then let me just give you a chance again. You know, our people are already really inspired about what you're doing. We're excited to have Emily from your staff on one of our to speak at our conference this year. But is there anything else you'd like to say to the 90-plus chapters throughout the U.S. and Canada that are already up and functioning and the other guests that are in the process of starting a group?
I just want to say thank you for what you're doing. CCL is terrific and I think is poised to be an organization that is at the pivot point and makes the difference as we move into the ability to do something on climate. And don't forget the oceans. Please, if you can, help us with the local information climate wiki. And to the extent you can forward my speeches around, let's keep the pressure up. We can't let them have the ability to say, well, nobody asked me about this, and duck the question. We've got to force it back into the center of the debate. And my last point, and I think I hope the compelling point in what I've said, even though the political conditions don't now exist for the kind of climate legislation that we need, they can be made to exist, and the tools to make them exist lie all around us. It's a matter of effort and organization. We can get this done. We can get this done a lot sooner than most people think.
Great. Senator, thank you so much. Appreciate you making time out of your schedule on a Saturday.
And everybody else, it's their time as much as mine. Thank you all.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, so that was pretty cool. So what we want to do now is hear some of the things that people accomplished and then get a general accounting of what got done since last month's call. I think this is as important as the educational part of our call because I think it's always easy to feel like you're kind of out there on your own and what you're doing is great. And for instance, we had 119 outreach events this month, 119 outreach events. A lot of those were tables at Earth Day. A lot of those were people giving talks. You know, Whidbey Island has been setting up meetings with all the other groups that have interests in their community to see how they can work together. And it would be easy to say, oh, someone just got a table and showed up. But everybody knows who's organized one of those. That is not what happens. That means there was a lot of organization, there was a lot of preparation ahead of time, so there was an enormous amount of outreach, and I think it's important for everybody to hear that, so you hear not just what you're doing, but that it's being replicated throughout the U.S. and Canada, and there's this huge push forward to make something happen. I do want to ask a couple people to speak on the call real quickly. First of all, Tamara from the Portland group, could you unmute your line for a second? Could you just say something so I can hear you? Go ahead, star 6 your phone, Tamara. That should unmute you.
I'm here.
Okay, go ahead. So Tamara, you started your group almost a year ago in Portland, right?
Can you hear me, Mark?
Yes.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
I'm here.
Okay.
Yep, I can hear you.
We started your group almost a year ago, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't an ideal circumstance because we started it in a bar. But nevertheless, we got it up and running, right? And, Tamara, I remember you saying, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to talk about this stuff. I can't possibly incorporate it. I can't understand it. And here you are a year later. How has that process gone over the last year?
Well, I guess the easiest way to encapsulate that or summarize that is just getting off the leader call last week. And Laura and I, in our past, my other co-leader, one of them, we would hang up from the leader call on Tuesday after you guys would speak about, you know, our actions and what was coming up. And we would hang up and we would call each other and say, what the hell? What was that? Like, I have no idea what they were talking about. I don't know who's in what seat in what state. And it just felt really confused. And last week I got off the leader call and I felt like, I know what's going on. In fact, I've taken a lot of those actions, and I can actually talk about a carbon tax without looking at notes now, and I can do a presentation and not be totally terrified of what questions are going to come at me, and it feels really amazing.
So, and then this week you had an outreach event where you talked to people at a speech by Dr. Hansen. You had an editorial board meeting and a face-to-face meeting with a member of Congress, and just give us a flavor of how that went.
Well, first of all, it was pretty epic to be at James Hansen's event. The whole Schnitzer Auditorium was filled with, I don't know how many people, but tons. And to be able to whistle and have James Hansen pause and say, I guess there are some members here, and have the audience laugh, that was pretty powerful. And to be able to shake James Hansen's hand at the end and have him thank us for what we're doing, and have people just, like some of the guys at our meeting today, who just would come up to Andrew and I and just grab these intro call invitations out of our hands. It was, that was awesome. And then meeting with, the editorial board of the Oregonian, somebody who has, historically published a lot of denier, skeptic, articles, and to be able to speak with him and at the beginning of the meeting have him say, no, I'm not going to stop publishing denier articles. And by the end say, wow, this carbon tax actually is one of the most promising solutions I've actually heard. And yes, I will publish your op-ed if you send one in to me. So that was pretty epic. And meeting Bonamici face-to-face, that was a really good experience too. Definitely made me a little nervous, but you know, she shook all of our hands at the end, and we... I came away with the understanding that she's pretty pessimistic about the situation, and hearing Senator Whitehouse just say, you know, we can create this, I'm looking at my notes, but basically that we can create the political conditions faster than we think. For me to think about the opportunity for Citizens Climate Lobby Portland to be able to be a resource for Congresswoman Bonamici is really exciting for me.
Great. I just think it's fantastic. Great progress in a year. Congratulations to you and everybody in Portland, Tamara. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Yep. Okay, Gary in Boston, can you unmute your line for a second? Just unmuting your line and saying something until I can hear you, okay?
Can you hear me, Mark?
I can hear you, Gary. So in Gary's group, there's a woman named Judy Weiss who's a rabbi, so it obviously doesn't make sense for her to be able to be on our call. But Judy published 75 letters last year. And I think you'll notice in the U.S. and Canadian action sheets, we ask everybody to write letters to the editor. And some of you might say, yeah, but that's what we do. We write letters to the editor. We do it every month. This is us. This is what we do. Well, what we wanted to do is tell you what Judy's doing, because I don't think, listen, let's say you got one letter last year or two letters, it would be a mistake to say, oh my God, I'm supposed to do 75. No, you're not supposed to do 75. But I do want you to hear what Judy's doing, because for some of you, you might see how you could expand what you're doing, because we want to keep expanding our messaging and all the people we're reading. So last week we had an interview with Judy Weiss, which we recorded and transcribed, and she can't be on the call, so Gary is going to play the part of Judy Weiss. So, Gary, is it okay if I call you Rabbi Weiss?
That's fine, Mark.
Okay, so Rabbi Weiss, how are you doing?
I'm fine today, Mark. Thank you.
Okay, good. So we've noticed that you get published a lot, and how often do you get published in North American newspapers?
It varies. Some months, 3, and the most I've ever had in a month is 10, and last year I had over 70 LPEs published.
And other than papers in Massachusetts, what are some of the other papers you get published in?
I've been published everywhere from Portland, Maine to Concord, New Hampshire, Santa Rosa, Salt Lake City, Richmond. The Baltimore Sun is one of my favorites to be published in, the Washington Times. I like the last two in particular because they're in the suburbs of D.C. and hopefully get read by the folks in Washington.
And there's a lot of reasons you like to publish in the Baltimore Sun. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
One thing I found out when I had my first letter published there is that they're part of a syndicate that picks up letters that have been published in the Baltimore Sun and republishes them to other papers in the country. So I've seen those letters in Michigan or Chicago papers.
So you write one paper, you write one letter, and it ends up in multiple papers.
That's right.
Okay. And then lately you've been targeting the Houston Chronicle. Why?
I've been targeting the Houston Chronicle, meaning I try to read it every day, and if there's something I can respond to, I do, because I started working with the CCL Boyle Group. The Houston Chronicle is influential in that neighborhood, and Exxon offices are there, so we're trying to change the tone.
Okay, so I get my paper, my local paper, and Steve Balk tells us, you know, to get published, one of the things you want to be doing is responding to what's in the paper. How are you getting information to respond to other papers around the country?
The Boston Group's really lucky because we have a guy named D.R. Tucker in our group. He basically searches all the papers across the country and sends everyone in the group articles that he thinks we should be reading. Everything that comes in from him, I either read it and discard it if I can't respond to it, or sometimes I don't respond at all. For example, I'm not going to waste my time writing to the Washington Post knowing that it's never going to get published. But with other papers, I make sure I answer in the same day.
Great. And so I've read a lot of your letters, and they're different. They're, different in content. They're different in tone. I noticed in your op-eds you reference them a lot. But what is your orientation, given the number of letters you write, how do you orient yourself in submitting all the different ones? Because I notice a lot of them are very different.
Well, first I try to write to a particular paper based on the style of that paper. So we have a paper here in Lowell, Massachusetts called the Lowell Sun. And I don't think in writing to the Sun that the first letter I should write to them about should be about carbon tax. They feature a little column every day on how much the price of gas has gone down or gone up, and they're not interested in talking to their readers about carbon tax. But I will write to them about things that are related and how we can help ourselves. I try to be lighthearted and humorous as opposed to didactic.
Great. Okay, and so then with the Lowell paper, it would be pretty easy to familiarize yourself, but how do you orient yourself? How do you find out a tone that would work with other papers?
Sorry, Mark.
Okay, well, we'll skip that one, Gary. We'll go to the last comment, okay, Gary? Or
yeah.
Rabbi Weiss. So I loved one of the letters Rabbi Weiss wrote where she used Harry Potter as a theme. I remember last month's call, everybody, that the Salt Lake group, who has that writing group, which I think is brilliant, they get together once a month and share notes. They had a very aspirational pieces having to do with using the moon launch as a context for climate change. One of the things that Rabbi Weiss did was actually use the Harry Potter books. Now, I haven't read the Harry Potter books, and actually this letter would usually be a little bit too over the top for us, but because Judy is one of the people working on the oil team trying to connect with oil executives, I didn't think this was too over the top. So, Gary, would you mind reading the piece that she wrote using Harry Potter as a context for our issue?
Sure. I'd be happy to read the LPE. That day I was responding to an article about how environmentalists who are pushing carbon taxes are basically President Obama's minions doing his work for him. So here's what I wrote. Dear editor, oil and gas lobbyists spoke out against the carbon tax bill because it would reduce our use of their products, and they worry about their bottom line instead of our national security and long-term well-being. One oil and gas pawn refers to the efforts of President Obama and his minions, which reminds me fondly of Dumbledore's army. I'm pretty sure Obama's minions are fighting a good fight to save the world from the likes of Voldemort. The oil and gas industry's minions resemble Dementors. They are the foulest creatures on Earth, draining the world of hope, peace, and happiness. Finally, in 2015, the American public is coming to terms with the severity of climate change, and we desperately want to maintain our standard of living without harming the environment. So what do the Dementors do? They fill the airwaves with negativity about the carbon tax plan, even though economists, scientists, scholars, conservatives, and liberals tell us it is our best hope. Dementors tuck away our hope and only lead to despair. What Dumbledore's army needs is Harry Potter's dark detectors, which can detect lying and concealment. Examine every statement made by the Dark Lord's Dementors when they speak out against the carbon tax, and you will find lies, concealment, and deception. Can't wait for the movie? Harry Potter 8, Greedy and Lying Bastards, is playing in theaters near you.
Okay, great. Gary, thank you so much, and thanks, Judy, for putting that together for us in advance of the call.
Okay.
All right, great. Amy Bennett, are you there? Can we get a quick summary of what happened this month?
Mark, can you hear me?
I can. So hold on one second, Amy. So I know, you know, like Salt Lake had its usual six pieces. Whidbey Island has been getting all the environmental groups together. Madison, we finally got record of the 22 radio shows they were on. Santa Fe won the regional standard, you know, sustainability award. Ashley and Long Island got in the New York Times. Pretty cool. Medford, Oregon, brand new group. Four letters, one op-ed at a meeting that was almost 2 hours with their member of Congress. Toronto raised a ton of money to send people to the conference, so there's really all kinds of remarkable things happening. We started new chapters in Missoula, Bozeman, Port Orchard, Washington, and Apton, Missouri. And then just in general, Amy, how many members of Congress or Parliament did we meet with this month?
This month we had 26 meetings with Congress and members of Parliament.
Wow. Okay. What about editorial board meetings?
There were two, Mark.
Okay, letters to the editor?
74.
And editorials?
6.
And op-eds?
18, Mark, and I actually have a list of the various cities across the country that had op-eds. We have St. Louis, Alexandria, Central PA, Los Angeles, Salt Lake City, twice, once in the Deseret News and the Salt Lake City Tribune, Orange County, Sudbury, Salt Lake City again, Ogden, Oakland, Traverse City, Syracuse, Ashland, Missoula, and Philadelphia.
Wow. And so then with the 11 articles, that means 109 pieces published, over 100 pieces published again. Amazing group of work with people. How many radio interviews this month, Amy? Because it looked like a big month for radio.
Radio, we had 12, Mark.
Okay, good. And then, as we said at the start of the call, 119 outreach events. And so, Amy, you've done those before, so that means just basically getting a table and showing up, right?
A lot more to it than that, Mark. I really have to commend everybody because this is a lot of work to put together one tabling event or one outreach event, and 119 just shows a ton of effort by all of our folks across the country.
Great. And of the 535 meetings with members of Congress we're targeting for the conference, how many are scheduled right now?
93.
Okay, 93, about 2 months out, so which is fantastic. That's way ahead of last year, but let's double down and make everything happen. Amy, great job. Thank you so much for that very concise report. Can you hand the phone to Judy?
Sure can.
Thank you.
Hello, Mark.
Hi, Judy. So your group decided to do something interesting and kind of outside of the box to raise funds for the national conference. Can you say what that is?
Sure, I can, Mark, and I'm not as used to talking, so I'll just pretend like I'm talking to you and not those 500 or 600 people out there.
Great.
I was at a fundraiser a few years ago with a friend and donated money to an organization run by a woman named Rachel. Rachel was helping women deliver their babies safely in a war zone in Africa. So I turned to my friend and said, somewhat sadly, how come I'm not doing anything that heroic with my life? She looked at me and said, Judy, it's people like you and me who go to work every day and donate to Rachel's cause that make her work possible. Without us, she couldn't do it. So we at CCL, we may not be delivering babies in war zones, but I'd say we're trying to deliver a healthy planet so future babies can enjoy it. And like you said, to make all of our CCL work possible, our North San Diego County group put together a fundraising campaign for the conference. Like the conference, it's called Creating a Climate for Change, and it's on the crowdfunding site Indiegogo. It is not a high-budget Hollywood slick video. It's sort of an old-fashioned multimedia presentation. A handful of us worked on it, and let's just say we have a cumulative age of way more than 100 years. So you get the picture about our technological savvy. But that doesn't matter because we put a lot of heart and soul into it. So raising money to pay for the conference, we set a goal of $60,000. It doesn't actually cover it all, but it's a good start. Now I hear the echo. This will help to cover the cost of the facilities, materials, staff time, and staff travel. So far, we have $760 raised, so we only have $59,240 to go. I figure that's about between $500 and $1,000 per group. So the length of the campaign is...
Great. Okay, so we may have lost Judy there, but the link to the campaign is at the bottom of the action sheet. Anybody who wants to participate is welcome to do so. And thank you so much, North County, Judy, and the rest of the group for setting that up. All right, Steve Volk, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Not very clearly. You need to speak up.
Okay, hold on a second. Let me turn off the...
I can hear you now, Steve. Nope, it's better now.
Okay.
What are the three actions? What are the two actions in the U.S., Steve?
Okay, so two actions in the U.S. The first one is to get businesses, organizations, and communities of faith and people of influence to sign on to CCL's letter of support for a revenue-neutral carbon tax. And included in that action is a link to the Federal Election Commission site that lists all the donors for congressional campaigns. And so the suggestion there is that if you look at that list and you see somebody you know, why not ask them to sign the letter, too? So then the second action is to generate letters to the editor supporting carbon tax and that gives revenue back to the public. And this will help to kind of fatten up our portfolio as we go to members of Congress up in Washington this summer.
Okay, Steve, we'll come back to you for the laser talk in just a minute. Kathy in Sudbury, can you give us the three Canadian actions?
Hi, Mark. Can you hear me?
Go ahead. I can, Kath.
Wonderful. So our actions in Canada are the Our Horizon Initiative. Since all politics is local and public education on climate change will vastly help our cause to create the political will for carbon fee and dividend, this month we are asking our volunteers in Canada to join on to an initiative from Our Horizon. Our Horizon wants municipalities to use their licensing powers to require gasoline retailers to place warning labels on gas pump nozzles similar to those on cigarette packages. And just imagine what it would be like for a candidate for member of parliament to run a campaign with lame climate policies in communities that have warning signs about climate change on their gas pumps. As well, prepare a dossier on your member of parliament, because in June, locally in your riding or throughout the summer, and then again in November in Ottawa, you will be lobbying your MPs for carbon fee and dividend. Before you meet with your MP, we want you to develop a 1 to 2 page dossier on your MP and send it to us for our files by June 1st. Ongoing, write letters to the editor, and there's lots of resources in there. And just a reminder, it's not too late to register for the conference in Washington, D.C. from June 23rd to June 25th, and we have 15 Canadians registered so far, and wear your hockey shirts, friends.
Okay, Kathy. Great, and that is so amazing. 15 Canadians are coming already. Inspires the rest of us to make sure we're there. All right, Steve, what's this month's Laser Talk?
All right. So this month's Laser Talk is all about getting people and organizations to sign on to the letter of support. So here it is. As we look to the future, you may be concerned about the impact that climate change will have on our grandchildren. A report from the International Energy Agency warned that we could be headed toward 11 degrees of warming by the end of the century if we don't start reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the next few years. That type of warming will create food and water shortages and make extreme weather disasters like Superstorm Sandy more frequent. We need a national policy that will reduce those greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. and encourage other nations to follow our lead. One of the best solutions is a steadily rising tax on carbon-based fuels with revenue returned to the American people. This approach is supported by conservatives like former Secretary of State George Shultz and Reagan economist Art Laffer. It corrects the distortion in the marketplace that leaves fossil fuels unaccountable for the damage they do to our society. By correcting that distortion, we can then use the power of the free market to make the transition away from fossil fuels and toward clean energy, thereby reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. Returning the revenue to the public will allow that transition to happen without a negative impact on our economy. To convince our members of Congress to enact such a solution, we have a letter of support being signed by businesses, organizations, houses of worship, and people of influence. I have a copy of that letter here. Would you look it over and consider becoming a signer?
Great. Steve, thank you so much. There's a bonus Laser Talk, which we will not deal with on this month's call, but we will deal with on next month's call, which has to do with the border. Just so everybody knows, the June call is going to be a training call. One of the things people ask me all the time is, how do I get caught up to speed with everything? What about exports? What about imports? What about China? What about how you compare a carbon tax to EPA versus cap and trade? What about different disparities between the different states? I don't know if we'll get to every Laser Talk we have, but you will get them in advance, including every single reference so that you have the backup material so that when you're speaking about issues, not only you're speaking about it, but you know all the sources of that information. So essentially the June call is a call where the time people are always saying to me, when do I get caught up so that I'm fluent on all the issues, the jobs, overall economic impact, what Pigouvian taxation is? We'll go through as many Laser Talks as we can, including the reference material, so that you could say that June is a breakthrough in our fluency, in our ability to express ourselves about the issue. The last thing I'll say is this, we have about half of the bios in for the conference. And if you've been assigned to the bio, if you could make sure you get it in the next week, the work that I've seen people have been done, I think give us the best possible chance of having a extremely productive meeting with meeting with members of Congress. So not only in one page, it includes religion, what we appreciate, where they stand on climate change, their committees they're in, the positions they've taken on climate, environment, energy, jobs, economy, national debt, national security, their key constituent concerns, what people are concerned about in the district and their personal hobbies, etc. So it is a really, really crucial piece of us having the conference be the breakthrough that we need it to be is that every piece of research is done. So if you haven't got that in yet, please get that into Laura. The forms are on the action sheet this month if you have not had a chance to get that in yet. All right, everybody, thank you again for a really, really remarkable month. I know we're all so happy that Senator Whitehouse could be on the call. Let's go have a great, great month, and we'll talk to you all on June 1st. Bye, everybody.